We've looked extensively over the past few weeks at Joshua chapter 1. We've seen the Israelites camped on the far side of the Jordan River. God's told Joshua and the Israelites that now's the time for them to enter that land that he promised to Abraham 400 years earlier. And now in Joshua 2, we see the Israelites making preparations to do that. And the preparations are kind of similar to the preparations that were made the first time the Israelites came to the edge of the promised land. You remember what happened. Moses sent 12 spies to look at the land, and 10 came back with a bad report. A report that changed the hearts of the people, that made the hearts of the Israelites melt in fear of those who were there and possessed the land. But now, in Joshua 2, Joshua gets ready to send spies out again. This time it will only be 2 spies. And this morning we're going to focus on the story of a woman named Rahab and her interaction with those 2 spies. She's one of the most fascinating people I think you'll ever meet in the Bible. Her story and her life is a story of how God's grace changes everything. It's an extended passage. Let me read it to you this morning. Joshua 2, beginning at verse 1. And Joshua, the son of Nun, sent 2 men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." And they went and came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab and lodged there. And it was told to the king of Jericho, "Behold, men of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land." Then the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who've come to you, who entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land." But the woman had taken the 2 men and hidden them. And she said, "True, the men came to me, but I did not know where they came from. And when the gate was about to be closed at dark, the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, and you will overtake them." But she had brought them up to the roof and hid them with the stalks of flax that she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued after them on the way to the Jordan as far as the fords, and the gate was shut as soon as the pursuers had gone out. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon all of us that are all inhabitants of the land, and we melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the 2 kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, who you devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is the God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that as I have dealt kindly with you, you will also deal kindly with my father's house, and give me a sure sign that you will save alive my father and my mother and brothers and sisters and all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death." And the men said to her, "Our life for yours, even to death. If you do not tell this business of ours, then when the Lord gives us the land, we will deal kindly and faithfully with you." Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was built into the city wall, so that she lived in the wall. And she said to them, "Go into the hills, or the pursuers will encounter you, and hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Then afterward you may go your way." The men said to her, "We will be guiltless with respect to this oath of yours that you have made us swear. Behold, when we come into the land, you shall tie this scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down. And you shall gather into your house your father and your mother and your brothers and all your father's household. Then if anyone goes out of the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we shall be guiltless. But if a hand is laid on anyone who is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head. But if you tell this business of ours, then we shall be guiltless with respect to your oath that you have made us swear. And she said, according to your word, so be it. And then she sent them away, and they departed. And she tied the scarlet cord in the window. They departed and went into the hills and remained there 3 days until the pursuers returned. And the pursuers searched all along the way and found nothing. Then the two men returned, and they came down from the hills and passed over and came to Joshua the son of Nun. And they told him all that had happened to them. And they said to Joshua, truly the Lord has given all the land into our hands. And also all the inhabitants of the land melt away because of us. Such a different account from what happened the first time the spies went in. The first time the spies went in, the hearts of the Israelites melted in fear. Now, the Israelites are told the hearts of the inhabitants of the land are melting in fear. But what I really want to focus on today is Rahab and Rahab's story. Coal and diamonds are made from basically the exact same chemical elements. But one we throw into the fire to burn, and the other costs you a fortune when you get ready to propose marriage. I got a text from my son this week. He's in Madison, Wisconsin, and his girl is in Memphis, Tennessee, or near Memphis. And he texted me and he said, hey, a flight to go see her will cost $300 to $350 and I'll miss a day's work. And he was kind of asking me, what should he do? And sarcastically, I texted back and said, is she worth it? And he said, yes. But so is a good engagement ring for her. Wow. The things you learn by text, right? Out of the blue. But rings are expensive. Diamonds are expensive. Same elements as coal, but one is made under pressure deep down in the earth. The pressure that makes diamonds makes them hard enough to cut glass, shiny and bright and translucent and of great value. But without that same pressure, those exact same chemicals make a fairly soft, very dirty, very black lump of rock called coal. As the Israelites got ready to take the Promised Land around 1400 BC, to an onlooker, it might have seemed to someone that Rahab was just a lump of coal, a wretched person. She was part of a group of people known as the Amorites that God had devoted and destined for destruction. Being an Amorite, well, you could say it was the first strike against Rahab. I think I need to say a word here about this, a word about the Amorites, a word about God's decision to destroy them. As we go through the book of Joshua, we're going to see that God is going to call the Israelites to do this same thing over and over again, to destroy everything, to burn entire cities. And for some of us, that offends our 21st century sensibilities. We're told over and over again, if there is a God, he's a God of love. And how can a loving God randomly order the destruction of whole groups of people, all the inhabitants of a city, including women and children? How can a loving God order such a thing? And the reason why we think this way is because we don't really understand God at all. We construct these little mental boxes that we put God in. And when we're doing that, what are we really doing? We're really making our own God, right? A God who thinks like we think, who has sensibilities like our sensibility. Rather than truly trying to understand who God really is, we're very content to make our own God that we're very comfortable with. I want to assure you this morning, God is love. 1 John 4:16 tells us that very plainly. Those are the exact words. God is love. But there are other scriptures that also tell us that God is just, that God is holy, that God cannot tolerate evil and sin. The whole book of Revelation is a book about judgment, a book about justice as the world ends and the new heavens and earth begin. Why is that judgment necessary? is necessary to purge and cleanse the earth of evil, so it can become the dwelling place of God once again. And today what we have is people who want to sacrifice God's holiness and justice on the altar of His love and mercy. But what would the world look like without God's justice? Do you really want to live in a world in which evil is not punished? Where there's no accountability for wrongdoing? Edmund Burke is famous for saying the only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. What if God did do nothing about evil? What kind of world would we live in? What hope would there be for us to live in a world where things would one day be made right? How many times do you see on the news stories where judges let criminals, guilty criminals, get off with no punishment? And justice isn't served, and those criminals go out and do very unspeakable things, unspeakable crimes to other people once again. How does it make you feel when you hear news like that? I'm sure, like me, you ask, where's the justice? This isn't right. We need to think of God in those exact same terms. The last thing God can be is an unjust judge, a God who allows evil to go unpunished, because that would mean He is condoning evil, which would mean He is no longer a holy and righteous God. God cannot and will not tolerate sin. It violates everything that He is. Scripture plainly teaches us that the punishment for sin is death. Romans 6:23 couldn't be any clearer. The wages of sin, all sin, is death. Sooner or later, a price has to be paid for sin. There has to be an accounting. Evil has to be punished. For Rahab and the Amorites, the time was coming right up to them. God was about to use the Israelites as an instrument of judgment against the Amorites. But before you start to think God's being unfair, know this: God's been very patient with the Amorites. God promised this land to Abraham 400 years earlier. Listen to what God said in Genesis 15. Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, speaking about their time in Egypt. And they will be enslaved and mistreated 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your fathers in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. From the time Abraham first walked the promised land, 400 years had passed. 400 years had gone by in which the Amorites could have repented and turned to God and come into line with God's expectations for how they should live. And yet instead, they became more and more wicked. Archaeologists tell us the Amorites worshiped Baal. And part of that worship involved acts of sexual immorality. They even practiced child sacrifice to their god Molech. One of the things they would do when they built a new home was they would sacrifice a baby and bury the body of the baby in the foundation of the house, thinking God would bring, that god Molech would bring a blessing upon their new home. Rather than being vengeful and mean here, God's displayed enormous patience. But now His patience has come to an end. And it was time for the land to be cleansed of evil. Judgment was coming. And Rahab was one of the Amorites who was about to be judged. Strike one, if you will. And it's not as if Rahab was a good person living amongst all this evil. No, how are we introduced to her here in Joshua 2:1? We're told right off that she was a prostitute. Puts her right smack dab in the midst of all the evil that was taking place there in the land. Second strike, if you will. An immoral woman living amongst an immoral people. And I want you to notice one more thing. Maybe you could call this the third strike. Rahab was a liar as well. In verse 2, the king sends his men to investigate this report of the spies being there at Rahab's brothel or inn. Rahab, just out and out, tells them a lie, telling them the spies had been there but they had left. And the truth was, she had hidden them up on the roof of the house. It's easy for us to look at that and excuse it, right? We do it all the time. We always find a way to justify speaking falsehoods. In 2012, Harry Reid, former senator from Nevada, told a whopper of a lie about Mitt Romney. He said he had evidence that Romney hadn't paid any taxes for 10 years. After the election, when that claim was proven to be a lie, Reid justified his actions saying this: Romney didn't win, did he? Here's what the Washington Post said about Reid's statement. Think about that logic for a minute. What Reid is saying is that it's entirely immaterial whether what he said about Romney and his taxes was true. All that mattered was Romney didn't win. And that's the world we live in. We are just like Isaiah. We are people of unclean lips, and we live among a people of unclean lips. Depending on what political affiliation you have, what Reid did may make your blood boil, but the truth is, we justify the same thing. We justify lying all the time if we think the lie we're telling is somehow for a greater good. But who decides what the greater good is? In Harry Reid's mind, the greater good was Romney not being elected. In Rahab's mind, the greater good is her life and the life of the spies being preserved. But both of them resort to lying to accomplish their purpose. We try to justify what Rahab did by saying it accomplished a greater good, that it was necessary to save lives, that any one of us would have done exactly the same thing. And all that's true, but still, a lie is a lie. And when we lie in a situation like this, what does it mean? It means that we're really not trusting God, but instead we're relying on our own cleverness, our own power to try to manipulate a situation. Think what we do when we resort to lying, even for something we think's good. We're relying on our guile, on our cleverness, rather than on God. And that's actually the greater sin, isn't it? Relying on ourselves. What's at the root of our resorting to lying, trying to manipulate a situation rather than trusting God? It's a lack of faith. It's unbelief that God's power, that our God can change a situation. We think we have to do something to help Him. But before we condemn Rahab for this, think about this. At this moment, who else did she have to rely on but herself? Why should we expect Rahab not to lie? She clearly knew of God, as you look at the passage, but she didn't know God yet. She didn't have any reason to believe His power would manifest itself in and through her life. She had no assurance God would act on her behalf. Lying was part of the culture that she lived in. And she didn't think a thing about doing it. It was what she thought she needed to do to survive, because she knew no other way to live. Three strikes: an Amorite, a prostitute, a liar. So easy to look at her life and think she's nothing more than a nasty, filthy lump of black coal, destined to be destroyed, destined to be burned in fires of judgment that were about to come. A sinful woman living among sinful people. But I have something to tell you this morning. Something that's not very flattering at all. It's something that we don't want to think about or to see in ourselves. Because oftentimes, we think we're better than we are. What I have to say to each one of us is that we're just like Rahab. Sinful people living in a sinful land. Our sins may be different from her sins, but we're sinners nonetheless, deserving judgment. We lie just like Rahab lied and think nothing of it. We fornicate, we lust, we covet, we steal. We have our own gods we worship and serve and bow down to and make sacrifices to. There's not one of us in this room that measures up to the standard of sinless perfection that God created us to have, or that God established through His law. And because of that, each of us deserves to die. None of us really should see ourselves as anything other than a black lump of coal destined for the fires of hell. Paul writes, quoting from Isaiah in Romans 3, "None is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they become worthless. No one does good, not even one." That's all-inclusive language, friends. Paul's not saying everybody except the folks gathered in Foothills on Sunday morning is part of this group. He's saying all of us are. None is righteous. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Why can the Bible say that about us? Well, for starters, because it's true. But secondly, think about this. On our own, apart from Christ, everything we do, even things that we think are good things, are nothing more than acts of self-preservation. Nothing more than trying to earn a righteousness of our own that will allow us to stand before God. It's the same thing that Rahab was doing. Trying to earn it. Trying to preserve her life. Rahab's doing a good work here. But here's the point. As she's doing this good work, who is she really doing it for initially? It's for herself. It's an act of self-preservation, just like every good work we do trying to earn God's favor is. Every good work we do apart from Christ is just selfish. Self-preservation. It's one of the things that needs to be on our hearts and minds as we come to the table this morning. Rather than thinking we're good people who deserve a place at the table, we need to see the truth about who we are. That apart from Christ, every single thing we do is selfish, centered in us. We can see how Rahab was like a lump of coal, but we need to take a long look at ourselves as we get ready to come to the table and see that we're no different, no better than she was. It's not as if we're diamonds that just have a little dirt on us that needs to be cleaned off. No, like Rahab, we too are lumps of coal. We don't need rehabilitation. We need transformation. And until we see this truth about ourselves, nothing will change in our lives. The Bible tells us, just like Rahab was destined for destruction, we too are objects of God's wrath. Paul writes in Ephesians 2:3, "You were dead in your trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of it, the air, the spirit that's now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of our body and mind, and were by nature children of wrath like the rest of mankind." We were by nature objects of wrath. Do you see it there? We were no different and are no different than Rahab was. We too, as sinful people, deserve God's wrath to be poured out on us. We too deserve to be destined for destruction. And like Jericho, what's God doing? He's being very patient with us, giving us time to come to Him and repent. But we need to understand this. One day that patience ends. And judgment will come. We're in the same boat Rahab was in, but something happened to Rahab, this wicked Amorite, that should give every one of us hope. Do you see what happened in Joshua 2, 9 and 11? She had heard about the true and living God, the God of the Israelites. And what she heard began a process that transformed her life forever in amazing ways. In Joshua 2, 9 and 11, she says that she knows the Lord's given this land to the Israelites. She says, "I know the hearts of our people are melting in fear before you, and our courage is failing. For the Lord your God is a God in heaven above and on earth below." Now I want to show you a couple things here real quickly. The first thing I want you to notice is that everyone in Jericho knew what was about to happen based on what Rahab says here. It wasn't like she was the only one enlightened to this truth. Everyone in the country's heart was melting in fear. Everybody knew Jericho was doomed, but only Rahab stepped out in faith to join the camp of Israel. God would have saved anyone else who was willing to join her, but no one did except for Rahab. Why? Because God had plans for her life. And so God went to work to call Rahab to Himself through His electing love. God graciously gave her a faith to see that it was useless to rely on herself, that she needed to turn to the true and living God, that it was useless to trust the massive walls of the city she lived in to protect her in the face of an all-powerful God. She needed to turn and trust God, the God of the Israelites. And God sovereignly, think about this, God sovereignly ordained for those two spies to show up there at her place. There were other places like hers throughout Jericho, but God divinely appointed for those spies to be there at that moment in time so that not just their lives would be saved from the king of Jericho, but that Rahab's life would be saved from the coming destruction. At this point, it's fair to say Rahab doesn't know much. All she knows is that Israel's God is greater than any God in her land, and she's ready to switch sides. Rahab didn't know the Ten Commandments. She obviously didn't know it was wrong to lie. She didn't know the ways of Judaism. She just knew this. This God of the Israelites, whoever He is, He's a true and living God. And I need to be on His side, not the other side. Because of that, she knew no matter how high and thick the walls of the city were, the city and all its inhabitants were doomed. And so she did the unthinkable. What did she do? She commits an act of treason against her own country. When the king sends these investigators to find the spies, what does she do? She protects them. She gives them aid and comfort, giving aid and comfort to the enemy. What is that? It's treason in her heart. She does that because she knows Israel's going to win, because she knows their God is a true and living God. That newfound knowledge of this God of the Israelites, it changed her. And the first step in that change was it brought fear to her heart. Notice what she says. Her heart's melting away in fear along with everyone else's. And that fear causes her to strike a bargain with the spies. A bargain that begins a transformation process in her life. Without having a clue of what she was jumping into, she chooses the God of Israel over her own wicked pagan lifestyle because she wanted to preserve her life. But God's orchestrating the means by which her soul would also be saved. Knowing her former way of life was doomed, what did she do? She took a leap of faith. She tied that red cord to her windowsill, a cord that would mark her house out for salvation. In the New Testament, the writer of Hebrews includes Rahab, this pagan woman, as an example of faith for all of us to have. Look what he says in verse 31. By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. This leap of faith changed her life in ways that she never imagined. I had a similar experience, a little different. I became a Christian as a 7-year-old kid at summer camp. And I became a Christian because I was so homesick that when the evening chapel rolled around and the fellow who was speaking began to speak about hell, it scared the liver out of me. And I decided it was time to become a Christian. I didn't want any part of going to hell. It would be fair to say that I got scared into being a Christian. It wasn't like at 7 I had done extensive research into all the religions of the world, into all the benefits of being a Christian. And it would take years for me to really begin to fully understand what being a Christian would mean for how I live my life. The moment I became a Christian, all I cared about was escaping the terrors of hell. It's very similar to what happened to Rahab. She was terrified of what was about to happen. And it was her fear that drove her to seek the God of the Israelites. And even though she didn't understand everything that was involved in what she was doing in this conversion she was about to take into Judaism, we can see her behavior begin to change. Think about this. This was a woman who sold her body to satisfy the lusts of men. And if she was willing to do that, don't you think she would do almost anything for a dollar? How easy would it have been for the king to bribe her into giving up that information? And surely she would have known she would have been rewarded handsomely if she had turned the spies in. But she doesn't do it. Rather than selling her information to the king, she protects the spies. In the New Testament, again in James, Rahab is commended for her faith, for putting her faith into action. James 2:24, you see, a person's justified by what he does and not by faith alone. In the same way, was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction? As the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without deeds is dead. Rahab's faith is a faith that leads her to take action on what she believes. And the book of James holds her out as an example, just like the book of Hebrews does, of what faith looks like. Faith involves action. To say we believe and then do nothing about what we believe, that's not faith at all. True faith always results in actions that prove that our faith is real. Rahab didn't know much, but she had faith that led her into a very uncertain future. I think when she struck this bargain with the spies, she expected, maybe I'll survive this, but I'm going to be a slave to the Israelites for the rest of my life. But God had something much better in mind for Rahab. God had bigger plans for her. By turning to the God of Israel in faith and trust, God went to work in her life. And Rahab and her family were certainly spared when the Israelites did conquer Jericho. In Joshua 6, you can see that the city is devoted to destruction. But Joshua, in verse 22, sends the two men in who had spied out the land, and he tells them, go into the prostitute's house and bring her out, and all who belong to her in accordance with your oath to her. So the young men who had done the spying went in and brought out Rahab, her father and mother and brothers and all who belonged to her. They brought out her entire family and put them in a place outside the camp of Israel. Now I want you to notice a couple things here. Joshua sent the two spies in to bring her out. They didn't wait outside for her to come out to them. They went in and got her. They didn't say, well, if Rahab wants to be saved, she can come to us. They went and sought her out. There's a lesson for us here in church today. Too often we're very passive and we just sit back and wait for people to come to us. And they hope they come walking through our doors. We need to be more proactive. Do you know the number one reason why people don't come to church? It's proven over and over again in studies. It's that nobody invites them to come. No one ever goes out and brings them in. Like those two spies, we need to be out looking to rescue those who are lost and perishing. Notice also that they brought her and her family out to safety, but did you see what they did with them once they brought them out? They put them outside the camp of Israel. They saved their lives, but put them outside the camp. It doesn't seem very hospitable, does it? They were not prisoners. They weren't slaves, but they certainly weren't welcome guests, were they? After all, she wasn't exactly the kind of woman you want living next door to you, right? In the eyes of the Israelites, she was still a lump of dirty coal, an Amorite, a prostitute. It was right for Israel, though, to leave her outside the camp. I want you to know that. God had told them very clearly that nothing unclean was to enter their camp. That included people. Rahab was still unclean. Transformation had begun, but there was still work to be done. But God had plans for Rahab. As Rahab turns to God in faith, God works to transform her life. Because God's grace doesn't just save us, it changes us. Look down a few verses later in Joshua 6, as they're brought out of the city, brought outside the camp. Look what verse 25 tells us. Just a short time later, Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute with her family and all who belonged to her because she hid the men of Joshua and that Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho. And she lives among the Israelites to this day. Do you see the change that took place? From outside the camp, now she's among the Israelites. By the time the book of Joshua was written and recorded as history, Rahab had become part of the covenant community of Israel. No longer just a lump of nasty coal, now part of the family. How did that happen? Do you remember what I told you earlier about the difference between coal and diamonds? It's all about pressure. The tremendous pressure that forms a diamond. Same is true with our spiritual transformation. Now you may be thinking, now I'm talking about pressure that was put on Rahab to change as her city's about to be attacked. Pressure that created fear, that drove her to the God of the Israelites, but that's not what I'm talking about here. And I want you to know this morning, and I can testify to this in my own life, fear will not transform anything long term. It may do something short term, but once the threat goes away, the transformation comes to an end. You need something more than fear to change. Fear doesn't create enough pressure to turn us from coal into diamonds. The truth is, it takes so much pressure to make that change in our lives that none of us could withstand that pressure. There's only one who could, and His name is Jesus. Think what Isaiah writes about Jesus in Isaiah 53. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon Him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with His wounds we are healed. Do you see that? Do you see what it takes to really transform our lives, to really heal us and make us the people God made us to be? It's not fear. It's not cleverness. It's not trying harder. It's that Jesus was crushed for us. At the cross, He stood in our place and was crushed. The pressure that was applied to us, to Him, was a pressure that not one of us could bear. Under the weight of God's wrath for our sin, He was not just pierced, He was not just wounded, but He was completely crushed so that we could be made whole. It's a pressure none of us can bear, but it's a pressure necessary to change us from coal to diamonds. Romans 8:1, Paul writes these words, "There is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus, because through Christ Jesus, the law of the Spirit of life set me free from the law of sin and death." Once condemned to die, Rahab has found freedom from condemnation through faith in the God of Israel. But God had even greater things in store for Rahab. Rahab is going to become a glittering diamond, transformed through her faith in God. In Matthew chapter 1, Matthew records the family tree of Jesus, and there's something very unusual about Jesus' genealogy. Back in the day when they compiled genealogies, back in Jesus' day, they never listed women, it was only the men. And they never listed anybody that would have brought shame to a family with their past. Only those who would stand out and bring good to the family name. But there she is. Look in Matthew 1 and verses 5 and 6. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of King David. And then you keep going, the father of Jesus. Rahab became the great-grandmother of King David and part of the family tree of Jesus, the Messiah. Think about that transformation. Imagine that, an Amorite, a prostitute, a liar, a woman doomed to destruction becomes part of the family tree of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. What a transformation. transformation that only takes place through God's grace and God's mercy. One of the things that's really interesting about Rahab is that every time her name is mentioned in the Bible, except for that one time in Matthew's genealogy, she is referred to as Rahab, the prostitute. Even in James and Hebrews, where her faith is held out as an example for us, that's how her life is defined. Her past would never be forgotten, but neither would her faith in God or the work of God's marvelous grace in her life. Being reminded of who she was and what she was, we see the greatness over and over again of God's grace and mercy, and we see its transforming power in her life. The glittering diamond really isn't Rahab's life. It's not even her faith. It is God's grace shining through her life. There was nothing she could do to save herself but cry out to God for mercy. And God poured out His mercy and grace in abundance upon her life. You know, in the time I've been in ministry, I've observed two groups of people. One group of people is a lot like me. People who have a hard time seeing our own sin. People who tend to look at a woman like Rahab and, well, we start to feel pretty good about ourselves because we can look at her and we can say, well, at least I'm not like her. People like me, we struggle to understand God's grace because we don't see ourselves the way God sees us. We have a hard time seeing ourselves as a lump of coal. And because of that, we have a hard time loving Jesus because we think we're pretty good and we don't really see that much need for what He did for us on the cross. We're very comfortable with ourselves because we always have the Rahabs of the world to look at and make ourselves feel better about ourselves. The problem, though, with our pride and self-righteousness is it covers up the fact that in our own way, we're just like Rahab. If we don't see our sin, then we won't see our need for Jesus. And if we don't see our need for Jesus, nothing is going to change because we'll never see our need for God's grace. Without seeing that need, God's grace can't begin to work in our lives to transform us from coal into diamonds. It's only as we understand the magnitude of our sin and the weight that Jesus bore for us at the cross that we're the ones who deserve to be crushed for our sin, that Jesus stood in our place, that God's grace can work in our lives and change us. The more self-righteous we are, the less we see that need. But there's a second group of people I've run into. They're a group of people who thinks they're so black, so nasty, so disgusting and filthy that they think somehow they're beyond God's grace and mercy. They think they've messed up so badly that God could never, ever transform their lives. I have a friend like that I talked with for years down in Florida. His name was Al, and when Al was 20, he was in a drag race with somebody else on the interstate down there, and Al's friend lost control of his car, and it flipped over, killing his friend and the girl that was in the car with him. My friend Al is convinced that he's beyond God's mercy. He went to prison for that, and he can't forgive himself for what he did. His recklessness took their lives. And he can't forgive himself, and he can't allow God to forgive him. He thinks he's messed up so bad that he's beyond God's help. It would have been easy for Rahab to think that way, wouldn't it? It would have been easy for her to think that somehow she was beyond God's grace and mercy. But in faith, what did she do? She cried out for mercy, and God took hold of her life and made something very special out of it. Think about that first song that we sung this morning, Marvelous Grace, Wonderful Grace of Jesus. I want to bring us back to that line, for the wonderful grace of Jesus reaches me. And as we get ready to come to the table, I have just this one question for you. And it's this, has the wonderful grace of Jesus really reached you and touched your life? If you look at your life and you think you're better than all the Rahabs out there in the world around you, I want you to know God's grace can never reach you. Grace and mercy are like water. They only flow downhill, and the only place they can wash over you is if you kneel at the foot of the cross in your brokenness and sin. You're the only one who can keep God's grace from reaching you this morning if you refuse to come to Him. You can keep it from reaching you because you think you're too good for it and don't need it. Or you can keep it from reaching you because you think you're so bad you're beyond cleansing. Even Jesus can't help you. But either way, if you block Jesus' grace from flowing into your life, you're blocking the only thing that can truly transform your life. Like Rahab, you cannot save yourself. Only Jesus can. As we come to the table, it's important for us to think about this. It's important for us to think about what this table means for us. Jesus said to do this in remembrance of me, but just exactly what is it that we're remembering? It's that He was crushed for us. The pressure that was brought upon Him is what changes us and transforms our lives. Each of us, we're nothing more than our own little Rahabs in our own little worlds, black, nasty lumps of coal. But it is Christ's grace and mercy flowing into our lives that transforms us into diamonds that show forth His love and mercy and grace to the world around us. It's our sin, it's our fear of condemnation that drives us to the foot of the cross. But it's Christ's grace and mercy washing over us that transforms us forever. Pray with me as we get ready to come to the table. Father, help us to see the truth. Help us to see our brokenness. It's so easy to look at the Rahabs all around us and think we're better than them. It's so easy to feel like a Rahab and think maybe we're beyond your reach. Would you help us to see this wonderful grace that we've sung about? This wonderful grace that we've talked about? Even now as we come to the table, with the grace of Christ flow into our lives, not just to wash us clean from our sin, but to transform us forever into a people who show forth Christ's grace and mercy to the world around us. Would you do this for us? We ask this in the name of Jesus. Amen. If you would join us and stand as we sing hymn 420 as we prepare to come to the table at the Lamb's High Feast.